We're going to start the State Government Finance Committee hearing. Representative Nelson, you want to move the minutes for March 5th?
Sure. I'll move the minutes, approval of the minutes.
Representative Nelson moves approval of the minutes for March 5th, 2015. Any questions? If not, all those in favor, please say aye.
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 Those opposed? The minutes for March 5th, 2015 have been approved. Members, we have Representative Driscoll is here. Kind of what we're going to do today. So we have two bills up. We have Representative Hortman and Representative Driscoll. And out of respect for their timetables, because I know a lot of members are having bills heard, as soon as they arrive, I'm going to take them up. So we might have to, you know, interrupt the presentation from the governor's budget. But we have Representative Driscoll here now. So we'll take his bill up right away. And then depending upon when Representative Hortman arrives, we'll try and we'll get her in as soon as possible as well. So with that, Representative Pugh, do you want to move Representative Driscoll's bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will move Representative O'Driscoll's bill, and it will be referred to House File 794.
Yep. So Representative Pugh moves House File 794 to go to the General Register.
Thank you. To the General Register. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Pugh. And Representative O'Driscoll, can you walk us through your bill, please?
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. We have a technical correction bill that's coming from the Minnesota Land Surveyors, and I have two members of the Professional Association that will talk more about the specific details. In your packet, there should have been a House research summary and some other data from the Minnesota Society of Professional Surveyors. This organization is made up of both public and private surveyors. So when we talk about public surveyors, they may be those that are hired by the county to oversee survey activity in the county. And oftentimes we'll have private surveyors who will do private work, platting of lands and so forth, and those two work in conjunction. With that, I'd like to turn it over to walk through some of the technical corrections to one of my two testifiers today. And I'd ask that he go ahead and introduce himself. And when you're ready, Madam Chair.
If you could please introduce yourself and state who you represent.
Good morning, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Michael Welling. I'm the Washington County Surveyor, and I'm here representing the Minnesota Association of County Surveyors and the Minnesota Society of Professional Surveyors. And basically what we have is it's a housekeeping. We had some issues where some of the requirements of the statute were spread around through the statute, and there's a lot of kind of confusing cross-references. And we've eliminated that and placed the majority of the requirements in one area rather than having the cross-references. We had some issues with the actual Mylar material that the plats are prepared on when a private surveyor prepares a subdivision plat. We've had some changes in the industry, so we've made some changes to address that. And then we had some issues with notary stamps and things like that. So for the most part, it is cleanup. And in the interest of brevity, I can answer any questions.
Madam Chair, if I might just supplement his comments.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. He does have, and if I could just ask him to hold it up, the Mylars are plastics that are used by surveyors when they do work. And the reference that he made to with problems with notary stamps, that it has nothing to do technically with the stamp, the process, the witnessing of a signature. It has to do with when you take the black ink and put it on the stamp and put it on the plastic Mylar, it smudges. And we've been doing that in the state of Minnesota for years. And as he's indicated, there's been some technology changes in the material standards that make it a little bit easier. And because of that, we need to do some changes in statute just to kind of get caught up with the 21st century on some of the technologies and some of the other kinds of information. The thickness of the Mylars, I know that we all lay awake at night wondering if those should be 3 millimeters in thickness or 4 millimeters in thickness. And we've adopted a new standard here in the state of Minnesota and proposing that. I know I didn't lose a lot of sleep last night. When I first started working on the bill, I was losing a lot of sleep over that one. So,
okay. And Representative Driscoll, did you have another testifier that you want to come? You don't have to.
Madam Chair, it's at the discretion of the committee. If they feel that they would like to know more information or have other questions, the resources are available at the discretion of yourself and the members of the committee.
Well, first, let's throw it out to anybody from the audience that wishes to testify on this bill. If not, members, any questions? Representative Carlson.
Madam Chair, just kind of curious, you talked about the ink smearing and what happens if that gets smeared, and, you know, that's part of a permanent record, so what's the next step if it's smeared and not readable, or is it not usually that bad?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My experience in real estate in 30 years tells me that it's not all that difficult. There are special pens, and the inks have changed a little bit on that. But, you know, we do have a sample here that you can look at. It's not that it's as clean and crisp. It kind of has some shadows and stuff on it when it goes on to there. And the notary still has to sign, so you get the signature of the notary with the Minnesota stamp that's issued by the Secretary of State's office.
Representative Carlson.
No, Madam Chair, it still sounds like it would still be readable, just smeared is what.
And again, if anybody would like to take a look, we do have some mylars here to look at. Okay. I know you want to take a look at them at some point in time.
Representative Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my questions are, as I see that, you know, on lines 2.11 and 2.12, when we have some exceptions, could you explain what we're accepting, what exceptions we're placing in here? I see a couple places where we're making exceptions from the standard, and I guess my question is why would we, you know, what those exceptions amount to? Why are we doing that?
Mr. Shepherd or Representative Driscoll?
That's our amendment.
Mr. Shepherd can help us out here. Mr. Shepherd?
We didn't have an amendment.
No, but that's the area that's being addressed by the amendment.
Madam Chair, there was an amendment that went on that addressed this in the previous committee. And I guess I'd ask Mr. Shepherd to answer Representative Howell's and others' questions as it relates to some of those exceptions that went into place.
Mr. Shepherd?
Madam Chair and members, the statutes that are cross-referenced here are primarily those that are laws governing common interest communities, and there are some provisions there that are a little bit different about the county surveyor approval and how the plat name and description appears. I have copies of all those statutes if you're interested in them.
Representative Howe.
Thanks for that. That's important to know. The other question I have is the repealer section. What are we getting rid of, and why are we getting rid of it?
Mr. Shepherd, can you help us out with that?
Madam Chair and Representative Howe, the repealer is a section. The first one is part of a law that governs the Department of Transportation, and it governs the marking of corners and establishment of witness monuments, and that is being replaced by a different portion of the bill. And there, the second repealer has to do with approval of plats and surveys and condominium plats for common interest community plats, and I don't have technical knowledge of that. I assume that language is, perhaps the witness can help, is also being replaced by a different standard earlier in the bill.
Mr. Welling.
Madam Chair and committee members, the 389 portion that's being repealed, there was a redundancy that there was the same language was repeated in subdivision 2 that was already listed in subdivision 1. It's possible that at some point over time these statutes evolved to the point where there became a redundancy in them, and so it was determined that subdivision 2 was no longer necessary. Okay. So the majority of that language is already in subdivision 1. The 160.15, that language is part of that streamlining where it is now, that language is now into 381.12, and that's where we got rid of some of that redundancy between and cross references between the two sections.
Okay. Representative Howe? Members, any other questions? Representative Edmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. With the change in the statute, would that cause any problems with homeowners, property lines, or anything like that that might change after they thought they've owned property and now things might change?
Madam Chair.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Madam Chair, Representative Detmer, there should be no physical boundary relocations that would be required or any confusions as a result of the clarifying language that this bill addresses. If I might just, for the committee's benefit, when we talk about common interest communities, about 21 years ago, the state legislature put into place updated laws that deal with common interest communities. For example, a condominium, when you define a condominium by legal description, you're actually defining airspace. You're not actually defining physical lands. And through the declaration and process that evolves on that, those are some of the technical changes that we're looking at making on here because of a law that we had 21 years ago and simply just providing some clarification for boundary definitions on that. So, again, that's not going to affect the common interest communities or other properties that may have lands with improvements in them as well.
Thank you. Representative Detmer?
Thank you.
Any further questions? Okay. With that, members, all those in favor of Representative
Not passed. You're going to vote, so that's fine.
Okay. All those in favor of House File 794 going to the General Register, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? There you go, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Okay. And do we have Representative Hortman yet?
Great. Lord.
Okay. So we're going to have the agency folks come down, if you could come to the table. Oh, she just showed up.
I'll give you 10 bucks.
Representative Hortman, we'll give you a moment here to kind of get yourself settled.
Only 10.
We'll have you come up and do your bill.
Was a snoozer.
Sorry, Madam Chair.
No, that's fine.
Got to spend a little more time in the tunnel than I anticipated.
Representative Hortman, I think just to give yourself a chance to kind of get settled, we'll just have Ms. Roberts just quickly run through the fiscal notes that's in your packets, members, while you're getting yourself situated, and then we'll go on to moving your bill. Ms. Roberts.
Madam Chair, members, you have a fiscal note in your packet that is on, actually, the fiscal note that's in your packet is on the amendment, 1A amendment. In the bill before it's amended, there is two fee increases that would create a slight increase in revenue, and I believe the Amendment 1A brings those fee increases back to current law, so there isn't a fiscal impact from.
Okay. With that, welcome, Representative Hortman. Representative Johnson, will you move House File 385 to go to the General Register, please? Representative Johnson moves House File 385 for going to the General Register, and then Representative Hortman, do you just want to briefly describe your amendment to get it in the shape that you wish?
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. The Minnesota State Bar Association Business Law Section took a look at a new provision of law we have coming into effect August 1st of this year, and they determined that some of the prior sections of existing law needed to be modified in order for business organizations to be ready for the change in law. And they were, as they were cleaning up the statute and trying to make everything consistent, they made the fees consistent across all conversions. And by doing that, they inadvertently raised a fee. So the amendment would revert just the fee language back to the original.
Okay. Members, any questions on the amendment that she has? Mm-hmm. If not, Representative Johnson, will you move her amendment then?
Right.
Awesome. Thank you. Representative Johnson moves the A15 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Okay, we've adopted the A15 amendment. And Representative Hortman, to the bill, if you just want to describe what it does.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, as I described the amendment, what the Minnesota State Bar Association Business Law Section did is they looked at the process of converting business organizations from one form to another, and they put some enabling legislation in place through this bill to make that process work with the new Limited Liability Corporation Act provisions that are in place starting August 1st.
Okay.
My shorthand is boring lawyer stuff.
Members, any questions? Are there any questions or comments from the audience? Representative Howe.
Thank you. I didn't get a chance to review it all, but I'm looking at the page 29 and 30 here where it deals with limited liability companies. Exactly what are the changes? I see a whole lot of new verbiage there. Is that replacing old verbiage? I don't see any strikeouts. So are we just adding requirements to limited liability companies and their operations?
Representative Hortman?
Thank you, Representative Howe, for the question. No, the act that we passed last year that comes into effect on August 1st actually streamlines the process for people who want to form an LLC. This is the process of converting an existing corporation to the new form that's easier to use. And so that's why there's new language.
Representative Howe. Okay. Any other questions, members? If not, Representative Johnson renews his motion to send House File 385 to the General Register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? Okay, so House File 385 will go to the General Register. Thank you, Representative Horman. Okay, with that, I'm going to ask that the Office of Administrative Hearings please come to the table.
Really?
If you can please state your name for the record and who you represent, please.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. My name is Tammy Poost. I'm the Chief Judge of the Office of Administrative Hearings.
Welcome.
And I'm here today to explain to you our request for deficiency funding this year, and I'll be very brief. First of all, 98%...
And Ms., can you speak more into the microphone?
It's certainly. Better?
Yes, thank you.
Great. 95 to 98% of what we do at the Office of Administrative Hearings is funded by state agencies, which means that when somebody challenges an action that a state agency has taken, there's a hearing, our judges conduct the hearing, and we send the bill back to the state agency. So we're not here to talk to you about that 95 to 98% of what we do, but there are two pieces of what we do that are general funded. One is data practices claims, expedited challenges to data practices requests. When members of the public believe that state agencies are not giving up information quick enough, they have a right to bring a hearing in front of us about whether or not they have a right to that data. That's one category. And the other is campaign, fair election campaign challenges. On the data practices request, we're only here asking you for $12,000. And the reason we're doing that is because the legislature has established a filing fee in these cases of $1,000, and it simply showed up to be $12,000 short. Now, in some agencies that are state general fund funded, you might expect them to simply figure out how to make that work. But the Office of Administrative Hearings, by statute, is funded as an enterprise fund, and so we can't look to the other state agencies to pay for these data practices claims, and that's why we have to come back to you every year to true up with you in terms of what the amount of cost was to us and what the amount that the filing fees generated. So that's the explanation for the $12,000 for the data practices one. The larger request, though, is for the fair election campaign cases. Those cases, the filing fee is $50. We get $130,000 that is funded by the legislature through a rider. That money is taken out of the campaign finance board's general fund appropriation. It goes to us. We spend $130,000 and more in a biennium on these cases. And we come back every year then to true up with you to tell you how much actually those cases cost. And this time they cost us about $100,000 more than the $130,000 that we were given. And that's the basis for our deficiency request.
Okay. Members, any questions? Representative Earhart.
I don't have a question, Chair, about the amount of money or anything we're talking about, but I'm interested in how are you some branch of the statewide judiciary? You're not a county. Where do you fall into the? I appeared before you guys for a campaign thing, but I never understood exactly what created you, where are you, and what are you doing here?
Who are we?
Yeah.
Madam Chair and members, thank you very much for that question, Representative Earhart. We are a court within the executive branch. We are not a constitutional court, so we are not part of the Remember the separation of powers, the legislative, the executive, and the judiciary. We are not part of the judiciary, what we call the Article III judiciary, the constitutional courts. Instead, we are a court within the executive branch that was created 40 years ago by the legislature to hear appeals to state agency action. So we're the trial court. If somebody doesn't like what the Department of Human Services does, or they don't like how the Public Utilities Commission set your rates, or you don't like what the Department of Commerce did to your securities license, you have a right to a trial. That trial is held by us, and appeals from us go to the Court of Appeals.
Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Ms. Madam Chair. Is that follow other states' performance or the way they operate this branch of the world of judicial?
Madam Chair and Representative Earhart, it does. Most states in the country have an administrative court within their executive branch and have what's called a central panel, which means instead of having each one of your state agencies hire hearing examiners who then try to judge the actions of their own agency when they're paid by that same commissioner or they report up to that same commissioner. Instead, you pulled all those things into a central panel, that's us, so that we can instead have fair and impartial hearing officers, administrative law judges, who are not accountable to the particular agencies.
Representative Chair, do you rotate in and out, or, I mean, are you a fixture of the of your department once you get there, like Hennepin County rotates people out of family or civil or whatever? And
Judge.
So how do you function? Are you there forever, or?
Madam Chair and Representative Earhart, I've been there for 2 years. It is a gubernatorial appointment with confirmation by the Senate, and it's a 6-year term. Okay. I was appointed in May of 2013.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I'm just interested. You commented that you were $100,000 short, and you can't go to state agencies for additional funding. So how do you handle the cash flow then?
Judge.
Madam Chair and members, every year we go to the Department of the Minnesota Management and Budget and we get our rates approved. And we're projecting how many cases we're going to have, how long are they going to take, and what's the right billable rate then to charge our agencies back. Projections are always just projections when we have to true up at the end. And so sometimes we build up a reserve during the year that we can use for cash flow purposes, but then because of state legislation that says we're an enterprise fund, we can't charge this back eventually to the agencies, so we have to come here for a true-up. Now, I have other ideas on how we could make this more cost-effective, but that's not the issue that's in front of you today.
But basically, Madam Chair, then MMB helps you with the cash flow so you can pay the costs until you come here to get it corrected then?
Correct, and then they put it into their deficiency request every year.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, Judge, so you don't have a reserve then now. You've exhausted your reserve that you have.
Madam Chair, members, we don't have a reserve and we're not entitled to collect a reserve, but certainly on a month-to-month basis, just given we will bill out the agencies and we will, but we've already paid staff, so staff is working. We don't wait to get the check from the Department of Human Services in order to cut paychecks to our staff. But that process all works into setting our annualized rates that are approved by MMB to make sure that by the end of every fiscal year, we simply cut even. We don't make more money than we needed to produce the services you asked us to provide.
Okay, but then do you say that traditionally MMB asks for this as part of a deficiency request rather than it coming from you, or is that not the case?
Well, as a member of the executive branch, all of our requests for funding come through MMB.
Okay, I see what you mean. Okay, Representative Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess my question is do you have a billable rate? And if you have a billable rate, when these take longer, these cases take longer or there's more cases, don't we bill that back to the agency as that billable rate, depending upon if we estimated 5 hours, well, this one took 10 hours, guess what? You're getting billed for 10 hours because that's what it took us.
Madam Chair and Representative Howe, that's exactly how it works for the enterprise fund portion of our business. but that's not how it works for campaign finance cases, because those cases aren't brought by state agencies, so they're not charged back to state agencies. Those cases are brought by members of the public or other candidates saying, I don't think my opponent or I don't think this candidate followed the law. Those people only pay $50 to bring that case, and then the rest of it we simply fund out of a pot of money that we get every year on a rider, this $130,000, or not every year, every biennium, $130,000 that's taken out of the campaign finance fund. So, yes, we have billable rates. Yes, we can float in billable rates with regard to whether we spend 5 hours or 8 hours on a case, but that funding stream doesn't affect campaign finance cases.
Representative Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I heard you say that you had some ideas on how that should be done. I'm all ears. I'd love to hear, because I've got ideas on how that should be done also. If you've got a candidate that did do something wrong, is there a way we can change our laws so they end up paying for those that did something wrong? And I have issues with, because I know in the past we've some of our fines have not covered what I think it should cover. So is that part of the fix?
Judge.
Madam Chair and members, certainly that's part of the fix. And also one part of the fix would be, right now the law requires that we have these campaign cases heard by 3 judges. It's the only kind of case that we have 3 judges assigned to instead of 1 judge. So that makes our costs 3 times as high if you were valuing costs based on billable hour.
Representative Howe.
Hey. Would that not be we have 3 because you've got a better chance of not having 1 on a political side of offense?
Madam Chair, members, I think that's the argument that was made when that was passed, absolutely. I know that when you go to the district court system to challenge things related to election law, you don't get 3 judges.
Now, Representative Howe.
I would love to sit down with you, madam, and work on maybe something to fix that campaign finance, because I've got one bill in that says you cheat, you lose your seat, and we've got some issues with that. I'd love to tweak that a little bit and see what you've got for advice to do that.
Be happy to do so.
And Judge, can you tell me, do you feel that moving forward that the demand won't be as high, given that you kind of had the first initial year and that there should be some prediction of, okay, you got the first year out of the way, going forward you probably won't need as much, even though your projections were off on the first go-around, the second go-around, maybe, you know, you've kind of gotten it out of their system, so to speak, if you...
Madam Chair and members, I believe that's true on the data practices cases, but not true on the campaign cases, and here's why. On the data practices cases, we've had this authority since 2010, and we've seen the numbers of those cases being brought going steadily down, which is why the request we're making this year is only 12,000 on those, because if there's fewer of them, even if we're off in the guesstimate of how much they cost, we're off by a lesser amount. The campaign cases, we haven't seen the numbers going down, and the costs are higher, and we'll come back to you with ideas on how to fix that. I do think there's one thing that's developed in that area of the law that might help us, and that is that the Eighth Circuit has declared a piece of our statute unconstitutional. I don't mean to say that I think that helps us generally speaking, but it will reduce the number of cases that come to us because part of the statute's been struck down as unconstitutional.
Okay. Member Cindy, Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And what area, Judge, what area or what issues bring the most workload for your agency?
Judge.
Madam Chair, members, the issues that are most often involved in our campaign finance cases are whether or not statements made by candidates either in their literature or out at public events are accurate and fair, or in fact are false and misleading. So they're very fact-specific kind of allegations that require judges to hear testimony about who said what to who and then make decisions.
Representative Demmer. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Poos. How do you handle the different cultures and languages that exist within our state, and how effective has your work with those minority populations been? Are they accessing the services, and are you able to provide effective representation or services to them? Could you comment a little bit on that?
Judge?
Madam Chair, members, my court does the work that we've been talking about. It also does all workers' compensation hearings in the state, and then it does all these cases that come out of state agencies. Within that, we have probably half our cases, the people who bring their appeals are unrepresented. And we have a very diverse population in the state of Minnesota and also in our courts. We hire interpreters. We have contracts with interpreters from various language and cultural perspectives to help make sure that all the litigants in front of our judges have a full and fair opportunity to present their cases.
Representative Johnson?
No, that's fine.
Okay. Representative Earhart?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have to rise to debate. What did you cast out there about the Eighth Circuit crunching in our campaign?
Judge?
Madam Chair and members, I'd be happy to provide a memo to the committee later to explain that to you in further detail. But the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals sometime in the last 6 months issued a case that said one of the provisions of Chapter 211B that has to do with what candidates can and cannot say was an unconstitutional infringement on the First Amendment. To get into more detail than that, it would probably be more helpful if I actually put it in writing for you, and I'd be happy to do that.
That would be great. That would be very nice, Madam Chair. I always watch what I say.
Yes, you do. Judge Poose, if you could get that to staff, they'll make sure it's distributed
absolutely
to members. Representative Pugh.
Yes, thank you, Judge Poots. I am noticing that the number of rule proceedings that went to hearing have decreased over the past 3 years. And I'm wondering if you could please clarify for the committee what the thresholds are, how is it, how many individuals or entities would need to come together to actually call for a hearing, and what the cost associated with that hearing might be for the individuals that request a hearing.
Judge Poose.
Madam Chair and Representative Pugh, you're asking about rulemaking hearings.
Yeah.
The statute that provides agencies different tracks on which to bring rules forward, first of all, emanates from the legislature. So you, the legislature, tell every state agency in every case, you can go down this path, or you can go down that path, or you can go down the other path. There are five paths to create rules. Each of those paths have different criteria as to whether a hearing is even necessary at all, and if it is necessary, how many people have to request it. The expedited path and the exempt path, no hearing is required. In the general rulemaking path, if 25 members of the public request a hearing, then there's a hearing in that rulemaking proceeding. In an expedited manner, another specific track, if an agency thinks this is non-controversial and starts going down that track and says we're not going to have a hearing, and then 100 members of the public say we don't agree, we think it is controversial and we want a hearing, then in those cases they get a hearing. Your question also had to do with the cost of hearings. Back to the conversation I was having with Representative Howe earlier, rulemaking hearings are charged at the billable rate that is approved annually by by MMB, and that's charged back to an agency. So it simply depends on how complicated the case was or was not and whether it went to hearing. Because there's legislation pending this session looking at rulemaking, I have done some analysis of what the costs of hearings have been. Of the 62 cases that came through us last year, only four went to hearing. The four that went to hearing, however, the average number of hours was 117 hours in hearing. Our approved billable rate last year was $165 an hour.
Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions, members? Representative Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Your Honor, do you hear the veterans hearing cases also? Does that come in from your hearing panel, or where does that go? I was just wondering how many of those you hear a year, if you do hear them.
Madam Chair and Representative Howe, we do hear some of those. We hear them on behalf of the City of Minneapolis and Hennepin County by contract, because the Office of Administrative Hearings has statutory authority to contract with local units of government. But generally speaking, the veterans' preference cases on the statewide level, we do not hear.
Representative Howe?
So getting back to that, you contract with two counties. How many of those cases do you hear a year from those two counties?
Judge?
Madam Chair and members, I didn't bring my statistics with, but my estimate on that would be somewhere between 8 and 10.
Representative Howe?
Thank you.
Representative Nelson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I was just wondering, keying off what Representative Earhart said, the question you said about the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals, is that people can make false statements in campaigns, or what it was that hearing? Because I think there's an article in this morning's paper about regarding that I read something about, and I think it's been in the paper a couple days this last week.
Judge, I think it might be helpful for you just kind of give us a little bit more detail, since members have questions about it, unless you're concerned about how you say it, and I can understand that.
Madam Chair, I'm only actually concerned about whether or not I can find that file in my brain to tell it to you accurately.
Right.
And I really think it would be better for you all if I actually put it in paper so that I don't misstate. And I'm sorry, I haven't seen the articles, so I can't tell you whether it's that case or not. But for the last 6 months, when cases have come in, we have been citing this case in our orders and simply saying and having to dismiss cases, saying that that's no longer a valid claim in the state of Minnesota.
I look forward to your memo.
I will get it to you by the end of the day.
Okay. And Judge, just the question that I have is, what was the reason, and maybe you don't know this, I've got staff that are looking for it, but what was the reason to repeal your authority to assess the counties for the cost that OAH?
Madam Chair and members, that was before my time, so I can't really speak to that. However, I can ask Pete Squirra from the Department of Revenue, who's on contract with us, to do our numbers for us, and he's in the room but does not know either. So.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll find out. Any other questions, members? All right. Seeing none, appreciate you coming today before the committee. With that, members, for the rest of the week, we have some bills up on Thursday. Tomorrow we have Minute coming before us to give their governor's a budget proposal, and then on Thursday with the bills, that'll wrap up our week. So with that, members, we are adjourned.